Hello, I'm Jessica Marquardt, and this is Kaleidoscope, the Cortical Visual Impairment Podcast. Two sisters. They're raising their kids together in the same community, their childhood community, in fact. They have a close relationship and similar life experiences, but you'd never know just how similar until you dig in. Anna Ault and Laura Kinney each has a daughter with a visual impairment. Their daughters are active and involved in community activities. They attend the same public school system. One has cortical visual impairment, the other an ocular form of VI called Leber's congenital amaurosis. And that's where their experiences begin to diverge. CVI is a brain-based visual impairment, the leading cause of pediatric visual impairment in the developed world. Leber's is an eye-based visual impairment and pretty rare. Kids with CVI can improve their functional vision due to the brain's amazing ability to change. Leber's is a degenerative condition, though medical researchers are actively studying how to cure it. Despite the fundamental differences between CVI and LCA, both children deserve access to appropriate medical care and educational plans. Both have great potential, and in this beautiful story, both have committed parents who would do anything to provide that access. Hi, Anna. Hi, Lori.
Hi, Jessica. How are you?
Hi, Jessica.
I'm so good. And so glad I have sisters joining me today. I mean, sisters are the best.
We think so, because that's all we have. It's just the two of us. So
I talk to my sister numerous times a day. I just got off the phone with her. I imagine y'all are very close.
Of course, now the best part is our children actually are growing up together. So my sister Lori is a big part of their lives. We live in close proximity to my parents' house. And we are in a rural area of we're actually in the Ohio Valley. It's the tri-state area of Ohio, West Virginia, and Pennsylvania. So I live 5 minutes from Lori and about 10 minutes from my parents' house.
That's awesome. So your kids get to spend a lot of time together. And we're here to talk about them. Your two special kids from your family, Olivia and Abigail. Anna, Olivia's your daughter. Can you tell us about her? What does she like to do? What makes her tick?
Oh, Olivia, she's, I always say once you meet Olivia, you will not forget her. She is so, she's like the sun. She's so bright, energetic, and lively, and she just lives literally in the moment. She loves interaction with family and friends, especially siblings and cousins, and loves parties and social gatherings, and she's definitely just her own individual person that shines so bright.
And Lori, what about your daughter, Abigail?
Abigail, she's 13 years old, and she's now going into the ninth grade, so she'll be heading to the high school. She's part of the Girl Scouts. She sings in the school choir. Previously, she's been on a swim team. She's been a cheerleader. She was involved in dance and tumbling and gymnastics. So she has tried almost everything that she can, and she wants to be very independent. And I just give her credit for wanting to try things. And just because of her vision issue, that she doesn't let anything hold her back. She tries and wants to do everything she can.
Wonderful. Two brave, amazing daughters who are getting into all sorts of things, living a full life.
We're very lucky that, like you said, we do live close and we are so active. You know, I think that's really a big part of their lives is that they are integrated into everything. Like Lori said, you know, Girl Scouts and 4-H and dance and, you know, just getting them out there into the world.
What I find so fascinating about your story is that each of your daughters has a visual impairment, but they're two very different forms of visual impairment. Anna, your daughter Olivia has cortical visual impairment, and Lori, your daughter Abigail has Leber's congenital amaurosis. Cortical visual impairment, or CVI, is brain-based, and Leber's, or LCA, is eye-based, primarily affecting the retina, correct?
That's correct.
Okay. Both girls, were they born with their respective visual impairments?
Yes. Abigail was born with Leber's congenital amaurosis, LCA for short, and it's hereditary. So yeah, she was born with it.
And so was Olivia. Olivia was born, her backstory is that she was born full term, no complications as far as pregnancy and had an emergency C-section concerning fetal monitor result. And unfortunately, 12 hours later, she started having seizures and she was life flighted to West Penn Hospital, where they determined she had a massive stroke prior to birth. So we knew the diagnosis right away as far as the stroke was concerned, but we were really unknown at that point on the cortical visual impairment.
So you knew that she had CVI right away, but maybe didn't completely understand the implications of the diagnosis. And Lori, did you understand LCA right away? Did you know what the diagnosis would mean for Abigail in the long term?
Not right away. We had to do some research and looking it up and finding information about it to see what it entailed.
Abigail was under the care of physicians, I'm sure. Were they able to explain to you the details of the diagnosis, where to get help and so on?
Yes. Once we finally figured out the diagnosis, so we noticed something that wasn't right when she was approximately almost a year old. And after a couple different doctors, finally, we went to a retinal specialist. The retinal specialist kind of had an idea that it was Leber's. She had to get her blood taken and sent to the Carver Eye Institute to actually get a diagnosis of what it was. When she was about 3 years old is when we got her diagnosis of LCA with the RDH12 mutation. After that, you know, we talked to the retinal specialist and did some research on what it entailed. So that's when we started finding out things about LCA.
How many kids are affected by LCA? And then how many are affected by her particular type?
They say 1 in 2 out of 1,000 births have LCA. Her particular type with the RDH12, we figure there's probably around that we know of 28 or so kids right now that we know of that have the RDH12 mutation across the United States and around Europe. And some of those are in the same family.
So incredibly rare.
Yeah, it is.
Which is interesting to look at those numbers and then to look at CVI, which Olivia has. And Anna, it's much more common, isn't it?
Oh, it is. And as you know, Jessica, and I know that CVI is the leading cause of visual impairment among children. So, and even with that said, I truly believe that there are so many other children, especially maybe with multiple severe disabilities, that are really not even diagnosed yet with CVI, or may never be diagnosed with CVI. And all of these children, you know, thinking about them, that's a loss and such a valuable time of especially neuroplasticity with the brain that can improve, especially the younger they are. Getting these kids diagnosed early and then referred to appropriate, knowledgeable medical professionals is really the key. Like you said, it's so different. You know, in our same family here, we have Abigail that has a genetic retinal degenerative eye visual impairment, and you have Olivia with a brain-based visual impairment. How rare Abigail's is, and yet how prominent, I guess, in the VI world that CVI is. It's kind of fascinating the differences there.
I find it interesting to think about how your daughters must have to approach the world in different ways to accommodate for their different forms of visual impairment. Lori, I'd like to hear from you. How is LCA affecting Abigail day to day?
She has no peripheral vision, basically. The way they explain it to us is that it's like her vision is like looking through straws. She has 10 degrees of sight. If you can just imagine looking through straws day to day, every day, approaching the world that way. She actually does very well. Sometimes people don't even really notice that she has a vision problem, especially when she's in an environment that she knows and recognizes she's good. But put her in a new situation, new environment, then she's hesitant, you know, as far as traveling. Her night vision is not very good. If you can imagine, when you go outside and come in from bright sunlight, and you know how long it takes for your eyes to adjust, you know, maybe a minute. Hers takes so long. She doesn't have the RDH12 to repair that. So that's why it's important that she wears sunglasses outside to save those cells. So she does fairly well for as little as she can see.
And when you first really started to understand the diagnosis when she was three, did you get plugged into services right away? How were you guided to understand her visual impairment better and to make appropriate modifications that would help her?
Actually, we talked to a retinal specialist, and then we got in contact with a group of families that have children with this, and just that communication and back and forth and correspondence of how we deal with our children and the teachers at the school helping out, and just the research that we've done and how to help her.
I think probably anyone who has a child with a disability, in our cases, a visual impairment, has to do a ton of research to figure out how to help their child, because as parents in our situations, we just don't have a visual impairment to this degree. We don't have their perspective about what it's like to live that way. So it's a little bit of experimentation, some observation, and of course, like you mentioned, a community of parents to support us is incredibly helpful. Mm-hmm. What about Olivia? How does her CVI affect her on a day-to-day basis? And what do you do to help her get through that, Anna?
Olivia, there's not a moment in time, I guess, where her CVI does not affect her day. You might see Olivia and think that she's a typical child, but the real story is that every day, every minute, she works 10 times, maybe 100 times, as hard as anyone else to really visually attend and focus and function. So by the end of the day, by the end of her school day, she's tired. I mean, she's exhausted. I really don't think I've ever been as tired as she is at the end of a day. She functions well. She functions well in the environment. She just visually fatigues. How we approach her is that we try anything we can do to visually adapt it and make life a little bit easier. And that's what we try to get across in her school setting, is that, you know, make these appropriate adaptations and accommodations so maybe she doesn't tire out so well. You know, how can we help her get through her school day? She doesn't have the benefit of incidental learning either. So, and we know, like Dr. Roman says, her eyes can see, but the brain can't make sense of the visual information. So how can we help her through that process? You know that kaleidoscope imaging, hence the name of your podcast, Kaleidoscope, she's unable to interpret that information, and she needs guidance through that process and repetition and just constant reinforcement of that are the only things that's going to help her get through that process.
So we have kaleidoscopes and we have straws going on here.
Yeah. It's looking pretty.
They're good ways to describe experiences that most people don't have. It's a nice way to put into perspective for people what it might be like.
Yeah. And I think it's hard to understand. Just like you said, it was hard for us to understand the CVI diagnosis, even though, you know, Olivia did get diagnosed early, luckily, just geographically, that we were close to Pittsburgh and Dr. Roman. But still taking that in, what does that mean? What does the CVI diagnosis mean? Means something different if you're a CVI diagnosis in phase one, phase two, and phase three. So it's not just a black and white answer of this is what you need to do. This is the equipment that you need. It's a process of learning, of adjustment, and it takes time and it takes energy and it takes people that, you know, want to learn, especially, you know, and she is surrounded by family and friends that are willing to do those things necessary to help her get to the next level.
Would you like to talk about the expectation of improvement in functional vision for a child with CVI?
Yeah, basically the expectation and the benefit of, you know, there's really not, I'm not saying there's a benefit of having CVI over an ocular impairment, visual impairment. But the good thing about CVI, if we can look at a good thing, is that these kids can see and they can improve. So their functional vision, you know, and it's assessed with the CBI range score to determine functional ability. And we know that's, you know, the only tested and true way. They need that range score to determine their functional ability to then implement a plan appropriate to their visual and educational needs. So it's a big deal. You know, it's a big deal to get that score. It's a big deal to understand that there's neuroplasticity. Dr. Lotfi Mirabet, that's currently the only researcher who's studying the cortical visual impairment in relation to neuroplasticity, he has said that CVI is a public health crisis. So again, what, you know, how are we going to improve her functional vision? Because it can improve. Unfortunately, Abigail, her vision can't improve. Luckily for Abigail, Abigail has everything else she needs. She's cognitively extremely smart. You can't get anything past Abigail, you know. Olivia, you know, she has a lot of delays and she has a lot of cognitive challenges, speech delays, fine motor delays. So there's a whole bucket of things that we need to work on. But I think really what floats to the top is the most important thing is her vision. Because if she doesn't have her vision, she can't get past anything else and her cognitive ability, and she can't progress.
Yeah. I mean, the reason for that, you mentioned, children with visual impairments are not incidental learners. Everything has to be put before them in a way that they can access their environment, their curriculum. So it takes a lot of focus and hard work in both situations because that vision piece is the window to the world, and it's essentially missing. Now, you mentioned that the CVI range is the only instrument available to measure functional vision in a child with CVI. Lori, can you talk about the process for measuring and evaluating Abigail's vision from year to year?
They take pictures of her retina and kind of determine if the retina has gotten worse, stayed the same. Luckily, the past several years, it stayed the same, which is great news for us because it is a progressive disease. The more that it stays stable, the better. So luckily, like I said, the past several years has been good. So they also measure her visual acuity. You know, normal is 20/20. She's usually around 20/400 is what her visual acuity is. They prescribe glasses for her, but it doesn't really help. They measure that and take pictures of the retina and just kind of do a basic eye exam on her once a year.
This may be a simple question, and by simple, I mean kind of dumb. Why don't the glasses help? Is it because of a field loss on the periphery?
Yeah, it's she has to have things that are... close. She has to have things close to her face. And it just doesn't help. And like the doctor said, if it doesn't help, then don't have her wear them. So for whatever reason, she's just, it doesn't really help her. So she's better off without them.
Is she a Braille reader?
She is a Braille reader. She's been learning Braille for the past, maybe about 3 years, 4 years. So because we never know, although she could still read print when it's magnified, we never know if she'll ever, you know, have to rely on Braille. She might lose her vision tomorrow and be completely blind, but now she knows how to read Braille and can figure, read signs, you know, out in the world. And so that's what we wanted for her, to learn Braille just in case she might need it. It's always a good thing that she can read in the dark if she has to.
Right, absolutely. You don't even need a flashlight. If you want to read in bed, you can do it so undercover. I love it. So with an ocular visual impairment, we were talking about taking a tactile approach for learning, Braille reading, also enlarging print and changing contrast on materials. But Anna, we know for CVI that there are many other things that we would do to make our materials accessible for children. Can you give some examples of what you do?
Sure. Yeah, it's definitely different. They did in Olivia's educational track, they did want to start Braille and Braille training and her learning Braille. And we know that that's not the best approach for a CVI learner, and that because her vision can improve, that we want her to be given the opportunity to use her vision, because if she doesn't use it, she could lose it. So we want her to rely on her vision. And that wakes the brain up and says, I need to start recognizing these shapes, these symbols, these, I need to visually be aware of what an exit sign is, what a fire sign is, what a stop sign is. I need to visually locate landmarks in the community, in my school. You know, I need to visually locate that that water fountain is close to my schoolroom, my classroom, and that I have to go right past the water fountain and turn right to get into my classroom. The adaptations are different. You know, we want the iPad is a valuable tool in her toolbox of you know, CVI modifications and accommodations. The iPad visually lights up the information with the backlighting feature. You can zoom, and that really helps to decrease the complexity. And with Olivia, out of the 10 characteristics that Dr. Roman mentions, complexity is one of the hardest things that she has trouble with. She really struggles with, if there's too much complexity, she's not able to visually locate that important sign or that important animal in the picture. If she misses that important animal, she might miss the whole point of the story. Even, you know, now looking at learning to read and sounding out words and identifying how words look and if they're longer words or shorter words. She can now identify words because they've been adapted for her. The shapes of the word have been highlighted. She's familiar with those. So the things that are novel to her become familiar with constant reinforcement and practice. And, you know, our hopes are that one day that she will read, she will be able to understand what she's reading and be able to answer questions on those. At this time, her stories are more of an auditory learning and fashion, but she is still reading some of the shorter stories and shorter sentences. And she is reading, you know, it's a work in progress. But every day, as long as her material is adapted correctly and in the best way possible, that those improvements will be seen. And I hope that continues. She is learning to use a cane. And we do think of using a white cane with an ocularly and visually impaired child like Abigail because they can't see. But a lot of it is for safety as well, for others to identify that Olivia does have a visual impairment. And so basically get out of her way. You know, maybe she needs a little bit of extra help. So it is an identifier in that way. It also for safety, if there's a drop off, if she's rounding a corner, if something might be unsafe for her. So, you know, that's such an important piece of the puzzle to Olivia's learning and functioning throughout her day.
Grace also travels with a cane, and I view it the same way. It's a signal to others that I don't see in the same way that you do. And also if she bumps into someone, people don't seem to take the same sort of offense to it. So,
right.
Yeah. And the iPad too. What an amazing accessible technology to have in the classroom. Grace pairs hers with the whiteboard, the smart board, so that it's right in front of her and that she doesn't have to contend with that complexity of the classroom around her. And that way she can really focus on what's going on up there. I told her we didn't have iPads growing up. And then she looked at me and she asked, "Did you have cars? Were cars around?"
That's yeah. funny, but yes.
The exactly. history of technology and how it's been rolled out and adopted, we don't quite understand that yet. But yeah, the iPad is key.
Yes. And the iPad is definitely Olivia's best friend. I mean, if you were to say who's your best friend, other than, you know, a couple of the girls she mentions at school, like, you know, Paige and of course, Abigail, you know, her best friend, you know, I would say is her iPad, because she loves it. She loves going through the pictures and the videos. And we do have to limit it sometimes, you know, she's still a kid and we're still, you know, we still have to take that parental role and say, okay, Olivia, enough's enough.
That's right. How much has her vision improved?
Olivia's definitely has improved. You know, it's hard to say if you asked me, you know, do you know where she would have been if we hadn't done everything? And knowing, you know, that question is hard, because knowing that we found out about CVI so early, we started then, you know, we started with early intervention with Help Me Grow. We had an amazing early interventionist, Jennifer Orlando, that came to our house every week. She would ignore my messy house and the fact that I haven't washed my hair in a week. And she would do all those phase one interventions. She would give us printed information, and maybe even at a time when I wasn't even ready to accept that information, you know, maybe I hadn't gone through that process, you know, when Olivia was very, very young. And she, you know, not only supported Olivia's development, but our emotional development and our commitment to this is what you need to do. And I watched and I learned. And I don't know where Olivia would be without that early diagnosis and early knowledge of CVI. And frankly, I probably don't want to know, because it might scare me. And again, that my heart breaks for maybe those out there that maybe aren't as lucky as us in receiving that prompt diagnosis and prompt interventions. You know, has her vision improved? Yes, because we have intentionally made those visual opportunities available to her, and at school, at home, and hopefully, again, like I said, at school, those things are still being done to visually make her, you know, progress.
Is she phase three on Dr. Roman's CVI range?
She is now phase three.
Oh, that's mm-hmm. wonderful.
And that's a hard phase. You know, it's good that we're there, but it's like we've climbed the mountain and now we're at the top of the mountain thinking, oh my gosh, where do we go from here? You know, I hope we don't fall and slip right down this mountain. But, you know, we're here and we're very thankful for that. But it's hard in the fact that, you know, there's only certain specific interventions that Matt Teigen and Marianne Roberto talk about. And we think, oh, we'd, you know, why can't we have a Matt Teigen or Marianne Roberto as a TVI? But, you know, everybody can't have them. You know, we have to hopefully get our team on board with what we're doing. It's hard to maybe tell somebody that we don't know as much as we should about a certain thing. Really, it's only for the benefit of Olivia that we constantly challenge ourselves with, what do we do next?
Olivia and Abigail are in the same public mm-hmm. school system?
Yes. They were in the same school for what, 2 years, Lori?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
I want to hear about this from both of you. Lori, you want to chat about how the school system supports and serves Abigail? Like, what sorts of things have they put in place for her?
Yeah, she is provided with two one-on-one aides, one in the morning, one in the afternoon. That's with her most of the day, except for lunch and things like that. But all her academic work is done with a one-on-one aide. They provide her with resources such as a CCTV, a note taker, a what's called a Mac Connect. It's a new device that she just got this year, actually the end of the school year, and a new note taker. Both of those things is wonderful. The note taker is kind of like a little computer, and it's a Braille keyboard. So she types all her schoolwork in Braille. She goes and plugs it in, and it prints out in print for the teacher to read. So it's just amazing how she can, I mean, type. She could probably type faster in Braille than I can on a computer. It's just amazing, because as a substitute teacher, I've been actually in her class and one day this year, and I'm just sitting there in awe watching her do her work, typing on this note taker, going to town on it. And it's just amazing what she could do with that. And then the Mat Connect, I'm not too familiar with it since it's new, but it's kind of almost like an iPad magnifier thing. So she'll be able to take a picture of something. It'll read it to her. She can magnify it. It's amazing of the resources that she has and is able to use. And she's able to use that, Braille, kind of whatever she feels comfortable with. If she likes to do something in Braille, she'll do that. If she rather do it on the CCTV, and it's all her. She's able to express what's best for her. And they also have a specific room called the VI room that she goes down with all her equipment if she wants to. Like maybe during test time, they'll take her down there, or she can stay in the classroom and have her devices there. So she's pretty much on her own what she wants to do. It's left up to her day to day how she uses her resources. So, you know, they've been wonderful. The school system's been wonderful in getting what she needs for her. So I've been blessed with that.
I love that she has that level of independence and self-advocacy to get through school mm-hmm. and life. Does she also spend one-on-one time with a teacher of the visually impaired and an orientation and mobility instructor?
Yes. The TVI, she's with her like one period of the day, which she learns the Braille. She does Braille practice and what's called talking typer, where she learns to, you know, type on the computer and keyboarding skills, basically. So she has one period of the day there. And actually, because she's high school age next year, she'll have an extra period of the day for types of learning like that. So with her new equipment, technology, Braille, some more time into the school day for that. Orientation and mobility, she does meet with an O&M specialist, usually a couple times a month. It was throughout the school, orientating through the school. But now, the past couple times, if we ventured out into the community. So she's actually been with her O&M instructor at an intersection, a busy intersection right in town. That was a bit scary, but, you know, I let them go and on their own. So, but she did fine. And also another place in the community, like the library, inside environment there. So that's what the plan is for now, is to kind of go move into the community more and orientate.
I can totally understand what you mean about being a little scared, and it makes me kind of chuckle. I've seen some goals written for orientation and mobility that would say something like, I don't know, navigating safely, maybe 80% of the time on X number of trials. And I'm like, no, wait a second. Yeah. No. I need for her to 100% not be hit by a car.
That's right. Yeah.
So with Olivia, what kind of services and supports is she getting in her school setting?
Lori and I both graduated from the district, and we have, you know, gone on to higher education. And so, you know, I feel that our district, Edison, has prepared us for our professions and our career. And I want the same for Olivia. I want the same for all my children. They do have a positive educational experience at the school. And I think a lot of it is because it is a rural setting. I know I was just talking with another mom that I knew that she graduated a couple years ahead of me, and she has a son with autism, and they actually moved back into the district from the Pittsburgh area because she wanted the teachers and the staff and the students to really know her child. And I think that's really what the small town community is that she trusted, you know, the district and to do the right thing. And I want to trust the district to do the right thing for Olivia, to give her the tools and the educators and the services that she needs to succeed. So the things that she has, she also in her school has a special VI room, they call it. And it's really just an area where she can go if she's learning something that's new for her. It's a darkened room. It has the CCTV. There's some modifications to the environment that's made. She isn't pulled out of her classroom as far as to the VI room through the entire day. She's still integrated with her classroom. But so she does use that VI resource room, I think is what they call it. She does use the iPad. And this year in particular, we've really made a lot of improvements and incorporated the iPad, incorporated some Google Docs in there that we can adapt with some CVI modifications. Like Abigail, she has the CCTV that will enlarge things mainly to get rid of all the clutter and the complexity from the other information that isn't appropriate to what she's learning in, you know, in one specific area of maybe a textbook or a handout or something, you know, that she's visually looking at. She does have an aide that has had CVI education. Actually, the aide and the aide that adapts her material, they both have taken the Perkins Roman CVI course at my request. And so, you know, I hopefully they really got a lot out of it and they wanted to. I know they were interested in what can we do that will best serve Olivia? So they were open to taking that, and I am very thankful of that. Olivia doesn't really see the TVI, the actual teacher of the visually impaired, but maybe twice a year. Now, there is a special education or intervention specialist that is designated for their VI, the visually impaired unit, is what they call it. So we do have her that consults with the TVI, but we don't have direct TVI services. But the intervention specialist that's head over the VI, she basically, you know, makes curriculum recommendations for the changes. The orientation and mobility specialist, I will tell you, that was one of the hardest things to get for Olivia. Years. I mean, it took years. Now, if I'm talking today, Olivia has an orientation and mobility specialist twice a month now. That person is also, luckily, CVI endorsed. So we really, you know, hit the jackpot with her because not only is she coming in for O&M services, but our district has agreed to bring her in as a CVI consultation and review what Olivia's, you know, the material that she's been given, review things that we can do to help her change and adapt the material that she's been given. You know, she helps her access her world. So she is that, you know, that one person that is really, you know, is going to be, I think, the key going forward now. And I will tell you, and anybody that's listening out there, this was not an easy road to find an orientation and mobility specialist. It was hard, but you have to be persistent, you know, and luckily, not only did it help Olivia, but of course, we have Abigail too, that she needed it. We needed to bring someone in that's knowledgeable. And again, luckily, you know, we have one too, that's knowledgeable, not only about O&M, but O&M with a CVI focus and that's CVI endorsed. I can't say enough good about that and really about this year with our school, the progress that we've made.
I feel strongly that every child with CVI should have a CVI range endorsed specialist on their team to help conduct and interpret the CVI range assessment, and also a mentor on that team who has experience with CVI specific to that child's phase and academic needs. I mean, that's the sort of expertise that's just needed to properly guide the planning of the individualized education and that day-to-day in the classroom to make sure that everything is designed in a way that provides access to the curriculum for that particular child.
Exactly. I think that can get lost sometimes in day-to-day, and I think we're all guilty of that. Day-to-day, we sometimes things get lax and sometimes we're not on top of things like we should be when maybe we're at our own jobs, and it just needs a refocus. And maybe it's a course, maybe it's a conference. It's definitely that CVI endorsed provider having a presence at the school and with those teachers and with those aides that are constantly with Olivia, that's what's going to make the difference.
And of course, everything that you both just spoke of in terms of services and teachers who come in to support your girls, it's written into the Individualized Education Plan, or IEP. So for those who aren't aware of this, can you tell me about the process, how you prepare, how you feel about IEP meetings? I don't know. Anything you'd like to share?
IEP is like, you know, the bad word, I think, of the house. It's like, do not say it. And, you cringe when you say it, IEP meeting. And early on in the educational timeline for Olivia, the IEP team meetings, they were easy. They knew what they were doing, right? You know, I mean, they knew what was best for Olivia, right? And then I thought, well, wait a second. As my knowledge of CVI increased and the fact that phase three CVI does look very different from phase one CVI, then that's where the hard part began. So the touchy topics there again are, how do I, you know, suggest at an IEP meeting that there needs to be more CVI education? I have a standard, you know, that I want Olivia's team to be at. Like, how do I say that maybe I feel that they're falling a little bit below that line? And so that's hard. And especially when you like the team. I mean, it's nothing personal. It's, you know, these are good people. They're in it for the kids, but you know, I'm in it for Olivia too. So needless to say, I've had some nightmare IEP meetings, and I know a lot of other people have, and things have been said to me that are literally burned in my brain forever that keep me up at night, you know, and again, only because my only intention here is to make my child succeed and become a productive member of society. But luckily, again, we've started to overcome those obstacles in the past year, and we've broken down those brick walls, and we've persisted in moving forward. So when you say IEP, and I think, oh my gosh, every February, every March rolls around, I lose sleep. I internet search until exhaustion. I think I gain 10 pounds. I make sure I have a box of tissues and a bottle of wine close by. You know, it's almost like, oh my gosh, January is like the start of it, and it doesn't end until that IEP meeting is over. Last March was a nightmare, a complete nightmare. This one, I can say it took a whole 180 degree turn, and I feel that we are on the right track. Lori and I kind of discussed IEP meetings, and I'm like, oh, the IEP meeting. And Lori, she can follow this up, but she was like, oh yeah, I just go in and everything's all good. And I went, what? You know? And so a little bit different perspective.
Well, yeah, I do have a little better experience with that. With the IEP meetings, really, it's been really smooth, luckily. You know, we just kind of go from year to year. And sometimes I make a change. You know, I see something that happened this year that maybe we want to change this year, or what we make sure we keep the same. I always definitely make sure that she has an aide with her. I don't want to lose that, because that was an issue at one time. But as for the rest of everything, just, you know, she has extended time on testing. She has all her resources she needs. So I've been lucky that it's been every year, it's been fine. And so I hope Olivia's IEP continues to be as good as it was this year, because it really makes a difference that you can go in with your team and everyone's on board with you. And it does. It makes the whole year go a lot smoother with a good IEP.
Yeah, it's the basis for it all. I mean, Anna, I'm really glad to hear it went a little bit better this year.
It did.
So both of you are highly engaged in your respective VI communities. I know Anna is committed to Pediatric Cortical Visual Impairment Society, which hosts an annual meeting, and that meeting has historically been held in conjunction with the American Conference on Pediatric Cortical Visual Impairment in Omaha. You were recently inducted into the PCVI Society Hall of Fame for your efforts, so Anna, bravo.
Thank you.
You can also find Olivia's PCVI Society fundraising page on Facebook. And just a side note on the conference that I just mentioned, the American Conference on Pediatric Cortical Visual Impairment, this is where I first started to fully realize the possibilities for children with CVI. So I can't encourage you highly enough to attend, everyone listening. It brings together not only parents, but also doctors, educators, therapists, and puts everyone from all these disciplines into one place to discuss how to move research forward, how to move advocacy forward. So look out for the next conference. Information for it will definitely be available through the PCVI Society website as soon as those next conference details are in place. And the PCVI Society is also a place for interdisciplinary conversations on CVI, and I hope everyone would join that as well so we can strengthen our ranks. Can you talk about how you embedded yourself into the CVI community, Anna, beyond what I just mentioned?
Yeah, I definitely can. And really started in August of 2014, I found out through, here again, my internet searching, my endless internet searching, that there was a PCVI conference. And I found the notes on that, and I read them, and I saw that they wanted to start a society. But of course, they needed the funding to do that. So literally the next day, that day, I planned our first fundraiser for the next week. It wasn't anything special. It was just a lemonade stand that Olivia did. But that just started our fundraising journey with the intent that we need to do this. Like I just felt this drive that we need to do it. And so my goal was $500. We ended up raising over $7,700. And that was, of course, thanks to all of my family, all of my friends, all of Olivia's friends and family, her team. Definitely couldn't have done it without the school that she was in and now that she's in, and that we continue to do fundraising for the PCVI Society. And in that June, after we raised the money, I told my husband, Tom, and I said, hey, so I was thinking, and he knows when I say that, he goes, oh no. What now? How much is this going to cost me? And I was thinking that why don't we just go to Omaha? Why don't we go to the annual conference and present our fundraising check and see what this thing is? When we went, I will say that we hopefully will not miss a year. If you are a parent or a provider of someone that with cortical visual impairment, this is where you need to be. And what way to, you know, better advocate and support these professionals that are researching, studying, writing, and assessing our children and supporting the advocacy efforts of not only them, but the parents. I have made it our goal every year that we do attend this conference. And I will have to plug thanks to family and friends that care for my other children during that time. That, you know, hey, we're going off to Omaha. And I think like you and Dan had mentioned, Jessica, that we do have CVI dates as well. And that's our CVI date weekend, is that we don't get away much. And when we do, it is usually CVI related.
I love it. And Lori, I hear it was a conference for you that introduced you to your people. Would you like to tell us about that experience?
Yes. The LCA conference, they were like every 2 years, and there was, you know, children there with LCA, there was workshops, and that's when my eyes were open to what LCA entailed. Then actually, credit to my mom, who did some research on our specific RDH12 gene, she came across a family in Massachusetts who put out there, we're looking for kids or adults, anybody with RDH12 form of the LCA. So we got in contact. Actually, I talked to her on the phone, and that's where it took off from there. I actually am part of the RDH12 Fund for Sight board. And it's a group, probably, like I said, there may be like a 28 kids, encompasses like 22 families, were like a fundraising group. And talking, her name is Jennifer, and talking to Jennifer, she just like opened my eyes up to what we needed to do. There's two things. You can sit back and do nothing, or you can choose to do something and try to save your child's sight. And that's what I wanted to do. I had to do something. So talking to her, she inspired me on fundraising, and then putting it out there to the community, to friends, family. At first, it was like, I kind of shied away. I didn't want anyone to know Abigail had a vision problem. You know, I was kind of like, I don't want anybody to know. But then I was like, well, what's there to hide? You know, she has this problem. And as soon as people found out about it, they were on board. They wanted to help. What can I do? Her school had, every year they would have a movie day and raise money for her. The church family has been a big part. They've done grilled chicken dinners, trash to treasure sale, random donations that they make. Friends have done a rockathon where we brought in our rocking chairs and we rocked all night. A Girl Scout provided a dance that for Abigail. Our big one, we did a charity walk. It raised thousands of dollars. All us families go together and fundraise to try to for a treatment for the RDH12 Fund for Sight. Each family tries to do a fundraising event, and we pool our money to fund our research for gene therapy. That's our only hope, is gene therapy. It's coming along. The researchers at the doctors at the University of Philadelphia are working on it now, and they're getting closer and closer, but it takes money. They're close to clinical trials with one of the other genes, the RPE65. They just, you know, approved a drug for that. I mean, they're that close. And we're just right behind it. And they're trying to find donors to donate, because to go into clinical trials costs a lot of money. We're trying to hopefully get donors to support it. But as for our families, we're working towards that and doing everything we can so that we could save our child's sight.
I learned a lot from the website, rdh12.org. So thanks for sharing that with me, Lori. Anyone who wants to learn more about Abigail's genetic condition and how to advocate for a cure, visit rdh12.org. It sounds like there is a cure for some people with Leber's, but one that wouldn't be effective for Abigail. Is that right?
That's right. As far as her, it's right now they say it will, the gene therapy will not give her back what sight she's lost, only that it will keep it from progressing. So that's why time is of the essence. You know, they say it's a progressive disease. So some people keep this type of vision all through. Some go blind completely. Some are born blind. Some have peripheral vision and some don't have peripheral. Some lose their central vision. So there's varying degrees of LCA and actually the RDH12 mutation. But the thing is, they say it's progressive, so we want to get a cure as soon as possible. So at least there's hope out there. There is hope and things are moving along. So that's what we hang on to.
Well, I totally admire both of you for how much you give back. There's a lot of philanthropic prowess in your family. Your fight against the status quo it's admirable. Both of you are just pushing forward to make life better for Olivia and for Abigail. But in pursuing this better life for your girls, you're also helping many, many other kids with CVI and LCA. Did someone instill in both of you this instinct to give back?
Basically, probably came from our parents. You know, they have an amazing work ethic. You don't quit. You don't give up. You do whatever it takes, and you do whatever it takes for your child. And thanks to them, I think it's in me. It's in my sister. My mom, like Lori mentioned, she does better research than the FBI. I mean, she will find out if something is out there. There's also that competitive gene that we have, that we will win, we will do what it takes for however long it takes, and we will prevail. So, you know, I credit our parents for instilling that in us.
So switching gears just a little bit, what do you hope will change for kids with CVI and LCA in your lifetime?
Go ahead, Laura, you can start.
We just want a chance for every day that Abigail can see is another day of learning. We never know if one day she'll wake up to a world of darkness, but we pray just that a cure will be available for her and others like her. There were two things that Abigail wants to see. And she says, I want to see a rainbow and the stars. So we hope that someday she will be able to see this, and other kids like her, that she'll be able to experience that.
Well, I should have went first because now I'm crying. as far as Olivia goes, you know, what do we hope will change? Basically, that everybody that follows that has CVI that comes through Edison Local School District, or that goes through any school district, public, private, anywhere out there, that they don't have to fight this hard. They don't have to beg for a CVI endorsed provider, even though that is new. And again, we have it now thanks to our district. But you know, that path is easier for them. I attended the CVI symposium at Perkins about a month ago. Jessica, you were there, and a lot of the other Tiger moms, as we call us, and moms and dad and Dan was there. It was inspiring. It was hopeful. That's how we feel about the Omaha conference as well. But I remember the opening remarks of Ed Bosso, the president at Perkins. He said, not only are we going to change the world, we're going to change how our children with CVI see the world. And that was profound. But I also wanted to add that we're going to also change how the world sees children with CVI. They can see, they can do, they can learn, they can improve, their vision can improve. So, and we do need to act now. You know, everything's a race against time. Olivia's 11, Abigail's older than her. It's a race against time, that our children might not be receiving the appropriate services, the access to what they need. And it shouldn't take years to get that. And so hopefully our actions have made a little bit of a difference. And just, you know, keep going, keep the hope alive, and know that a CVI mom's job, or a CVI parent, or any parent, our job is never done.
That's right. Thank you. Thanks to both of you for joining me. It's a great conversation and really compelling to hear a story from two sisters talking about these parallel but unique experiences. So thank you so much.
Yeah, I want to thank you for having us on and letting us share our story with you.
I know we threw out a lot of potential resources today about learning more and advocating for CVI and LCA. Just check out our show notes for links and ideas. Hopefully we didn't overwhelm you, but at the very least, we hope you leave this conversation knowing that we are actively building and strengthening our CVI community. We believe that children with cortical visual impairment have a right to visual access and educational and social inclusion. I bet you do too. Join the movement. Find Start Seeing CVI Advocacy on Facebook. Thanks, y'all.